Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, episode whatever the heck it
N
is.
Plus one.
I am Chad Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And today we have
PY from Square.
I was hoping
that totally
you would
say avoided
your name.
The whole pronunciation problem.
I was going to be like Pierre-Yves.
How would you say it if you?
My name is Pierre-Yves, but people call me Pierre or PY.
I can see why.
Probably. They call me lots of names besides Chet, but they're not really
some words
we don't use on the podcast. So from Square, doing what kind of stuff do you do at Square?
Android development on Square Register. How surprising,
you're on the right,
right
podcast. That's excellent.
how awkward if we got someone that was actually doing, like, I don't know, RIM development or something. Like, wait a minute. Who booked this guest? Okay. So what kinds of stuff do you focus on there?
These days, mostly running around.
Okay. All right.
Fixing the hard bugs and this kind of stuff, and teaching people, like I'd say, and feature development. It's funny. I actually don't use a lot of the recent Android features usually, and most of our, I don't know why I think about that right now, but most of our engineers don't, just because we have so many users that don't use the latest Android stuff. So it's mostly writing new screens, new features for Square Register, which is a register. So like an app that you install when you're a cashier or when you want to take payments and when you want to manage your business.
So would you say you do more development on the client app itself, the register app, or the back end of that where
the client app, definitely. Yeah.
And you said you fix difficult bugs. Would those include like memory leaks by any chance?
Interesting that you ask. Well, not anymore.
You have no more leaks.
Yeah. No,
so you just worked yourself out of a job by writing?
A leak canary.
Whoa. So this is actually what spawned the idea for having you on the podcast, that you had put this thing out on Twitter. I'd sort of seen it mentioned, and I ran into it at a really horrible conference. and then we talked about it, and it seemed sort of an obvious thing to talk about on the podcast anyway. So tell us more about it.
All right. So Leak Canary is a leap to detect memory leaks. And to do that...
Okay, I was afraid it was a way to like leak canary builds of Android. I'm very relieved, Ryan.
So it's a tool to detect memory leaks on Android, basically in your apps and also in AOSP. That's not the primary goal, but it just happens to be a side effect.
You just want to point the finger at...
Of course I am. Okay. No. I'd say most of the memory leaks we detected actually were fixed in the latest versions of Android.
Actually, so I first ran into Leak Canary online because I saw some forward of a Twitter thing or something. And then the second time I ran into you, I think Romain had forwarded me a bug that you filed. I didn't actually know that you had filed it. But I was like, oh, yeah, that's a leak. We should totally fix that. And then it came up later like, oh, yeah, you found it by running your app and pointing the finger at it.
Yeah, I didn't do any actual work to find that leak. It's just like...
So
showing
can you
up.
Sort of do the 30-second elevator pitch for the canary? What is it?
30 seconds. Okay. So we know our apps have a limited amount of memory, right? And when there's no more memory, it crashes. In Java, everything is garbage collected, so it makes everything super easy, right? We don't have to care about memory management, except we do. Because when we're done with something, we release that object, and the garbage collector, we just dereference it, and the garbage collector is going to take it, unless something else is referencing it. So if you think about an activity, when the activity on destroy gets called, you're expecting the garbage collector to garbage collected because you shouldn't be using it anymore. But if you put your activity in a static field, then the garbage collector can't collect it, and that is a memory leak. It's actually very hard to detect, right? And it's been the Java existed before Android, of course,
well,
right?
It's hard to detect because it might not be a leak.
Yeah, well,
right? It's like
yeah.
It's referenced, so your app could potentially be using it. So it's really programmer intent. Did you actually mean for
exactly.
this to no longer be
exactly?
Used?
Actually, yeah, that reminds me of that. Yeah, the reason. So the way you try to detect that, right, is by, I mean, if you're thinking like very basic thing, you could write finalize method in your object and just count the number of references, right? And you'd say, oh, this hasn't been garbage collected, so it might be leaking. Or it might just be that the GC is lazy and doesn't care for now, right? And that's where things are kind of tricky.
Or the way that I have chased some of the leaks that I have created in the past were through using the tools that were available at the time. And that's a much more intensive process of, okay, you take the dump and you convert that and then you run Matt and then you look at a lot of data and try to understand it. And it takes a while to get there.
Yeah, I think Matt is a fantastic. So we're talking about Eclipse Matt, memory analyzer, and it's a fantastic tool to identify leaks. In fact, Leak Canary is actually using that. The problem with Matt is the first time you get in that UI, you have no idea what you should do. It's showing you a bunch of reports, which are not that terribly useful for Android, really. And so the general approach to finding and fixing a memory leak, the first thing is you need to know that there is a problem, right? So usually you kind of, before Leak Canary, I guess you just kind of poke at random and take a heap dump, open it in Map, and you look around and like, so is there some kind of object that should not be in there anymore? And then you find that object, and that's, so say, an activity that's been destroyed. And then from then everything is super easy, because all you have to do is just do an operation called compute shortest path to GC roots. And it's going to show you the shortest chain of references from that object to a GC root. So that would be, for example, a static field. The way I like to explain that is to think about the memory as a directed graph. So every object references other objects, right? And the garbage collector actually doesn't do reference counting. What it does, it identifies components or islands in that graph. So like, say, a subgraph that's isolated and not connected to anything. So like, there's no object referencing any other object in that graph, I guess. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense right now. We don't have drawings to show these things. But basically, when that's happening, then it can be garbage collected, right? And so what you're doing here is trying to find, you're looking at an object, and you're trying to find all the connections to that object and find the path to one of the GC roots. And when you find this chain of references, then in this chain of reference, there is one of these references is causing the leak.
Okay. So how do you know... What's the trigger in Leak Canary to know, to look for these references, to know, hey, something probably leaked, let's figure it out?
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting question. So let's look at activities, right? We know they have a life cycle. So we know after they've been destroyed, there should be garbage collected. So we set an application life cycle callbacks something, a listener that will get called every time an activity on destroy method is called. And then it's actually very simple. We take that activity reference and we put it in a weak reference, and then we wait.
So the critical point here is that this is not like Matt, a static analysis tool that takes a heap dump and does analysis. This is something that actually, I mean, your tool puts itself into the user's app and is actively monitoring it, right?
Yep.
And how often is it running? Is it running basically on every activity lifecycle event, or is it running regularly, or is it running on exit, or what's the invocation?
So that's a very good question. It's running, so two things. It's only on dev to on dev build, right? You don't ship that to your users. And it's on lifecycle events, so on destroy. So so the first part doesn't have anything to do with Matt. So the first part is basically, oh, the activity was destroyed. Let's wait a little bit, and then check that weak reference, and if it hasn't been cleared, then the activity object is still in memory. And so if it's still in memory, maybe there is a leak. And that's when, so we do, you know, system.gc, you're not supposed to, but I kind of try to trigger the GC, wait a little bit more, see if it's being garbage collected or not. If it's not, that's where things become interesting, because you can start doing a heap dump. And then what Leak Canary does is it actually runs Matt, but on your device. It forks a new process and then start analyzing the heap dump on the device.
I can't imagine the Eclipse UI running on my little phone screen. That's got to be out of control.
Yeah, well.
Buttons and menus everywhere.
So the story around that is that, Matt is, so a long time ago, someone built J-Hat, and then that became Matt, which is both UI and the heap dump parsing. And I think 4 or 5 years ago, someone forked Matt, removed all of the UI code and kept this core heap dump parsing code. And then 2 years later, someone took that and added Android support. And then it was left hanging on some random repo. And I found that. And I'm lazy. I don't like to write a heap dump parser. So I just took that and I basically wrapped it. And that's what I'm using.
Turns out we actually have one ourselves now, too, in Android Studio. You know, in 1.3, we added a heap analyzer. And so that also does the, you know, the dominator computation and all that stuff.
For actually, that's very, very interesting. And I actually plan to use it.
All right.
Because, well, so we were just talking about that before the podcast with Android M. Some things have changed in the memory management, I guess, and the heap dumps are not being parsed by this fork that that was forked 4 years ago.
Yeah.
They are being parsed by the new tools library, and they are being parsed by Matt, the latest version. Yeah, I don't know what changed.
I know that the person who wrote this library, she was working closely with our team to figure out things
and
so forth. Yeah.
Problem. So I do intend to actually replace what I have for the heap dump parsing and use that. The only problem is that it depends on Guava and then on a bunch of other things that kind of needs to
We have Guava sort of in the tools. It's one. It's at like at the root set of all the dependencies. We have Guava. Just makes it easy to deal with like reading and writing files and things like that.
Slightly different constraints when you're running an IDE on the desktop.
Yeah, because our tools are not really, our heap analyzer doesn't run on Android, right? So
yeah, I know. That's why I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, if I'm going to fork it and just like maintain my own. I really like that.
I would say bytecode manipulation, that's the way to go.
Oh, and then just erase everything?
Just replace all the calls too, because I'm sure it's not using much Guava. I'm sure it's going to be at the I.O. stuff.
Yeah,
we don't tend to use a lot of Guava. There might be like some array, there's a multimaps in a few places, but multimaps and file utilities mainly what we use. I'm sure there's some miscellaneous other utility call, but I don't think up in that library. Yeah. That library is probably going to be limited to that, I would think.
I think it's basically some collection stuff. And I'm definitely still looking, playing around with that.
So the stuff in Android Studio is going to be a more general thing, right? It'll be more similar to the UI of Matt, I assume, where you can sort of trace the references to anything because it's doing analysis of the entire heap dump, whereas Leak Canary is focused on exactly the things that you wanted to track references on, right? So you can say track references on this this activity or on fragments. Can you track it on any particular object?
Yeah. So the API is basically here's it's watch this object, right? So activity.undestroy is an easy one, but we've done it with any kind of object that has a lifecycle. So fragment is a very good example. In our apps, we have the notion of a scope, and when that scope ends, we do track it. There's only one trick here, which is, or one caveat, I guess, which is that taking a heap dump actually freezes the VM for like a second or two.
Yeah, I've seen the toast pop up on my phone when I was using this, saying, hang on, we're busy.
And so when you have a lot of memory leaks, then this happens a lot. And activity.undestroy doesn't happen that often, but if you have like fragments and you're moving around in your app, every time you're moving around, you're going to get a freeze because you have a leak. So I would say turn it on like, just to try, fix the most important ones and then turn it on for real. But like if you turn it on for all of your dev users, like all of the engineers working with you or the QA, then everybody's going to hate you for freezing the app all the time.
Or if you forget and leave it on for your users?
Well, that would be really terrible.
Yes.
But can that happen? I mean, I actually don't know how you instrument it, but is this a Gradle plugin?
No, it is an AIR library with two versions of it. So the idea is in debug compile, you include one, and in release compile, you include another. That doesn't do anything.
Yeah, that's what I would think. Because I would think that, you could basically prevent this from happening. If you build with Gradle, you won't actually... It's not a matter of you forgetting to take it out. It's just that it won't get compiled in.
Okay. I think the instructions don't actually call that out.
They just say copy-paste this into
exactly, into the build.gradle file.
I tried to, in a few places, it mentions, don't use that in your release build. Because one of the other things that... So this is think of it as a picture of memory, right? So it has everything that was in memory. And right now, it stores it on the SD card. So if that was a production app, then it means everything that was in memory, including potentially your password, your private information, would be in that memory dump in your SD card. So no, don't use it in release build. It's basically the idea.
Fair enough. So it's a really nice tool. The places where I have injected issues like this in the past were really non-obvious to create. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it in the first place, and tricky to track down. Like you only find out much after the fact that, you know, where did this memory go? Or an app submits a bug because they're crashing due to, like, you know, after several configuration changes, eventually the system runs out of memory because you have these massive activities taking up all the space. And then you go and you once you know the problem, then you can spend some quality time with the tools and track it down. But just knowing that the problem is there and it's a really horrific problem is super awful. So the ability to actually put in something simple here that says watch my activity or watch my fragments or whatever, and then it'll call attention to itself when and if it needs to, is pretty cool.
Yeah, one of the problems, I guess, is that, or one of the things I came to realize is that there are an awful lot of memory leaks. That includes your app, older versions of AOSP. I mean, there are still new things in AOSP, but I definitely noticed that it shrink down. But, like, we still have to support older versions of Android, right? And the problem is, before you take the heap dump and analyze it, there's no way you can tell what's going on and why you have a memory. Where's the memory leak, right? And you can't fix, or it's really hard to fix the one that are in Android because, if you want to do that, then you have to start using Reflection usually, and it can be terrible, but it can also help fixing that problem. So it's kind of a balance. And then
Do you do that in your app?
Yes, we do. Not for every single one, but the ones that we notice are the most common. We try to do that in a very sensible way where, you know, if the field doesn't exist, then it's okay. These kind of things. But
Is this part of your, like, say, the Square register code base, or is it available as a library that someone could?
So we have that in our register code base. I haven't put out any of that code because I don't consider it, like, good enough to be shared, and I'm a little bit ashamed sometimes of that code.
Reflection code being iffy?
Yeah. But we do, so there's a file in Leak Canary that's basically what we call ignore leaks. The idea is that you want to focus first on your own memory leaks, and if Leak Canary finds a leak that's a device leak, it's going to not report it to you. You can change these options, but the idea is focus on yours first. But if you look at that file, you can see, I mean, it's kind of fun to read all that because you can see every single, you know, I'm not going to name names, but like a constructor.
It's a hall of shame.
Yeah, it's a hall of shame, yeah. And you have a few comments explaining how you could potentially avoid that memory leak or fix it.
Speaking of which, so in working on this and using it, you must have found a lot of common patterns. So, I mean, activity leaking is a really horrible thing, especially since every time you turn the phone, you're leaking another one, and they're potentially very huge. So I know the common ways that I have bumped into this before in my own code, but I'm sort of curious what are the common ways you've seen?
So one of the first thing I mean, I kind of knew it, but I hadn't realized is you think about a view, a simple view like a button, right? And you could say, oh, what happens if I leak a button, right? Nothing. There's just a text inside. It doesn't really matter. Well, it does, because a button has a reference to its parent. The parent is a view group, has a reference to its parent and to its child. So you're leaking just a button, but what you're actually leaking is the entire view hierarchy and all its bitmaps, and as well as the activity, because the view has reference to the activity. So this is the first thing I realized, like, you can be leaking a very small thing, but if you're leaking just one view, you're leaking everything. And an activity, like in the Leak Canary sample, it's an activity with a button. It's about 4 megs. It's just like crazy.
It's a really nice button, though.
It is a nice button. Another thing that one of the trick that I've learned of that I've seen a lot, both in AOSP and in our own code, and I think you've seen that one too, is when you set an on pre-draw listener on a ViewTree Observer. One of the trick that happens is when you call get ViewTree Observer, if the view is detached, then you don't get the real ViewTree Observer. You get a fake one, right? And so if, after being attached, you get the ViewTree Observer and attach an on-pre-draw listener, and then the view is detached, and after that, you try to remove your on-pre-draw listener, if you call get ViewTree Observer, you're going to get a different ViewTree Observer instance. You're going to get the fake one. And so you can't remove that pre-draw listener, and then it's going to hang on in that ViewTree Observer forever until you rotate the screen, I guess. And so it's one of the common leaks that I've seen in a lot of places. And so the idea is basically you need to remove your on-pre-draw listeners before your views are detached. Otherwise, you're going to have problems.
Actually, the one that I've run into is about listeners in general, because you'll probably create a listener as an anonymous inner class, which then has a reference to the surrounding instance. In this case, like if you're in the middle of, you know, a button, a view, you create this anonymous inner class that has a reference to the view. The view has a reference to the context. So the problem I've run into there is when I need to know about things in a global context and you have a static map, I would end up using like a weak hash map, and I eventually called it leak hash map because it gives you the impression that you're keeping weak references to these things. But because of the way that weak hash map actually works internally, you end up caching these instances of views between configurations and leaking the activity because of that propagation all the way up from the inner listener.
I think that was a very common thing that was happening in prior to Android maybe 3 or something, where set tag would use a weak hash map, right? When you did set tag with an ID and a value, it would use a global weak hash map. And so if you put a view in there, it would leak the entire view hierarchy. And that has changed probably with ICS, I think. Not sure.
Not sure. I joined around 3.0, so I'm not sure. And I think this also runs afoul to one of the ways that Android works compared to many other platforms and systems that I've worked on or other people worked on, where the idea of a process is not the same as an activity, right? So your process is long-lived between configuration changes, but that activity got torn down and recreated. Did you really want a static map? Is that really what you meant? Or do you actually want something that's actually tied to the life cycle of the activity instead?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, basically, you should know that static fields are generally, when it's not simple object immutable values, then static fields are usually going to do bad things to your app. It's kind of the thing that I see a lot is related to managing threads, right? So you send you click on the button, you start a new runnable that's going to run and run for a while. And because it's a runnable and you define it as an anonymous class, it has a reference to its outer class parents, its outer parent class. And so as long as that thread is running that runnable, then the runnable is not garbage collected. The hidden reference to the outer class is not garbage collected. And that's these are like, I guess, short-lived memory leak, but longer than intended. It's actually one of the variants, like the reason I started looking into that is because we started with a very common mistake that everybody does. In Square Register, there's a screen where you can sign with your finger. So it's basically a giant bitmap. That's just the size of the screen. And we kept getting out-of-memory errors reported from our crash reporter. So we looked at that, and we're like, what can we do, right? And so, well, maybe we realized, oh, we're signing in black, right? So there's just one color. So we should use Alpha 8. So that's going to make the bitmap smaller. Still didn't work out. So then we tried, I've been reading the source code of Latin IME, the keyboard, and I learned one trick in there, which I tried to apply there, which is you try to do the thing that you want to do that's going to be costly in memory, and then you catch out of memory error, then you trigger the GC, wait a little bit, and retry. That's what the keyboard does when you try to inflate the view hierarchy. Anyway, so we tried that, which... terrible idea. It didn't fix the problem, and the code was terrible. And what we eventually realized is that the problem is not that you're trying to create a bitmap that's too big. The problem is that you're running out of memory. So you need to fix all the memory leaks so that you have enough space for you. Like a bitmap that's a few megs, you're supposed to have more than enough memory to handle that in a sane app.
So was it the previous bitmap? Was it because of a leak and you were still retaining a bitmap the size of the screen from the previous configuration?
It's basically what's interesting is we started using Leak Canary and we fixed memory leaks everywhere except in that area. There was nothing in there. And the out-of-memory error just dropped by 94%. And all of those were actually that signature screen. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because when you're close to the limit... it's going to crash when you try to create a huge amount of memory. Right?
Or not even a huge one, right? So that's a problem we have sometimes with Studio. We get out-of-memory exceptions, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get a thread dump that's pinpointing the problem. But that's really just pointing out the unlucky code that happened to be running when you were at 100%. And it might be that the culprit is hiding in the 80% of the heap, right? And there's the last 99% are legit.
There's also the problem of fragmentation. I don't know what versions were you actually hitting the out-of-memory error on?
All of them.
Just all of them?
Yeah.
Because like previously when we would allocate bitmaps in the native heap, you wouldn't run into the fragmentation issue. But as soon as in 3.0 we started putting it on the Dalvik heap, and Dalvik doesn't compact,
yep.
Which means as you're allocating more and more due to these leaks or just due to general operations, then all of a sudden you may have enough memory, but it can't find enough contiguous memory for that large object.
Yep. So you use the F word for heap fragmentation. Interesting. Okay.
As opposed to podcast names.
Well, usually when journalists talk about fragmentation, they talk about like hardware, like you know, there's different hardware doing different things.
No.
So you actually talk about real fragmentation in the old Windows defrag meaning of the word. Nice.
Exactly. I always loved running the disk utility on Windows where it would actually show you like this nice color graph of how awful your disk looked.
Yeah, and you'd feel better that next morning, you know, after it's been sort of flipping bits back and forth.
It's all green. My life is better. Yeah. I wish we had that.
I'm sure if you look in the Play Store, I'm sure you'll find some like app claiming to defrag your Android OS.
I bet it's like a flashing ad banner in an awful game.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and maybe you could move stuff around in your SD card. Just trying to do that in somewhere. I don't know.
Or just draw a new green bitmap and tell people.
It's good. Just it's green now.
Yeah.
So if people want to play with Lee Canary, what do? They basically search for it and then they add it to their app or their build.gradle or what?
Yeah, they basically, it's like two lines. They add two lines to their build.gradle to add the dependency. And then in the application class, they add another line. Well, that's at least the basics, and then you can customize things.
Although when I was playing with it, so I basically never create an application class because I'm normally just creating an activity, at least for my simple demo apps. And I found it was easier just to say, give me the application, like get the reference to the application from the activity, and then pass that in to Lee Canary.
So what I found is actually most developers actually do create this, so that's why it's the easy spot. Like they, 90% of the time they already have one, so they have this method and you just like paste this code in there. But you could totally do it at the activity level.
As long as you're only doing it once.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise you're like leaking Lee Canary and then Stack Overflow.
Yeah. It's actually one of the...
I wonder if your library could automatically have one in its manifest and provide one. And then that would be used.
Like if you could have some sort of thing like, I mean...
We already have manifest merging, right? So if your library provided...
Had an application class that would be called by the main application class or something, that would be... Actually, it wouldn't be too hard to do, right? Because you just have to, maybe in the support library, have a base application class that you need or something, and that would try to look for these things in some way. It's a good idea. Yeah.
All right. What else should we talk about?
So there was a few things you had mentioned. Actually, the one that triggered for me was we had recently done a conversation with Chuki, a video interview that they did at Google I/O with Tor and I, where we talked about presenting. And I saw that was one of the things that you were interested in as well. And that's the context in which I met you because you were presenting or on a panel at this conference.
That we won
panel-ish. So I was curious about your take on technical presentations. Any tips and tricks?
Yeah. So I mean, I think there's a lot of common stuff that we kind of all agree on. The one thing that I used to, when I started presenting, I used to think, you know, I'm gonna just take a random subject, and because of the pressure that I'm presenting to someone, to other people, I need to not look stupid. I'm gonna learn the subject, and so I used to do that for a while. And it somewhat worked, but I found that I do much better presentations when I've been actually working on that for like a long time and I know my stuff.
Turns out
being
knowing
an expert actually helps. All
right.
Wow, let me write that down as a note here. Okay.
But I've heard so many times like just pick a random subject and then study it and then present it, which I think works, but you're just not going to get the same type of depth as you would as an expert. The other one that, I mean, I have my few tricks that are like, I think everybody has kind of the same tricks, but one of them is just by the audience by asking them simple questions that you know they will, like, raise your hand and say, who here is an Android developer or, like, who likes chocolate, whatever. Yeah. And people raise their hands, and because they do that and you do it a few times, they...
Stay awake.
It's kind of they both stay awake, and it's kind of a manipulative thing where they kind of want to say yes to whatever you're going to tell them. because it's a reinforcing pattern.
Okay, so point two is manipulate your audience.
Yeah, that's important.
All right, great. Then
another trick that I like is using dark slides. So basically refocusing the attention of the audience on what you're saying. It's the same sort of things that not putting too many words on the screen, right? Where people are just going to read your slide when you move to the next slide. So don't put too many words and then acknowledge that they're going to read your slide. So if you want to say something important, just put a black slide or say a dark slide. I tried putting a black slide.
So when you say dark slide, you don't just mean dark background, white text. You mean dark as in that's all that's on there. It's just a dark
like
color.
Like a brown.
It's actually dark text on dark slides.
Okay. Really maybe you can read. Yeah. I usually put some sort of logo or whatever because I try with full black and people would like interrupt me and tell me the screen isn't
projector's
working.
Projector's broken.
So I know better now.
Interesting. Yeah. I heard about that. I think Chuki was talking about that as well, like some presenter that it just went dark and this was intentional because they wanted to refocus the audience. Wake up.
Yeah.
Or go to sleep or whatever.
Well, I think the example she gave was where the speaker was really trying to make an important point and they wanted all eyes on the speaker.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing, there are a few things that I learned too. Like I guess, introducing yourself is nice, but nobody really cares. So like we don't care like where you work, what you do in life. You can if it's important to you, you can communicate that throughout the talk. But like apart from your name, it doesn't matter.
At least in the presentation. It's probably important to have a bio so people know whether they should bother showing up if you are an expert. Like that's kind of where you make the case that this might be worthwhile. But but probably not.
Once they're in the room and you have the microphone.
Yeah, they're locked in.
Yeah. So. Java 1 used to have this slide template that started with like one or two slides of introduction to speaker, like why people are in the room. I'm like, you're already in the room. Why am I wasting your time talking about this? I think social media has helped a little bit with that because it's easy to put a Twitter hash Twitter handle or whatever. And then people, if they're interested in following you or figuring out more about you, then they can go there. And that's just kind of a quick link. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. You mentioned dependency injection. I guess you have opinions about that. So this is interesting to me.
It's sounding very enterprising.
So it is. And I'm not sure that – no, I'm sure that I can't speak knowledgeably about it because it's not something that I use. But I know that the topic came up a lot in the series of articles that we were pushing, the developing for Android stuff, because it's a common thing for people to use, especially for testing frameworks they have or whatever. But it's also – it allows really obvious pitfalls and trip points for Android developers to run into where they're going to do stuff that is not going to run well on the platform.
It seems like Square is very on board with dependency injection.
Yeah. So the first thing, which is interesting, I think, is you said, I don't use dependency injection. And are you sure?
I am sure that I have never written code that was intentionally doing dependency injection.
So why
do you ask?
The reason I'm saying that is because most people actually are doing dependency injection. There's the tooling. And there's the pattern. And the pattern is basically writing objects that don't know how to get their things. So if you pass a bunch of arguments, I have the coffee machine and then that's a bad example. I don't like the coffee example. But I have an object that needs something else to work, right?
Can you relate this to animation in some way? I think that would help you.
That's a bad example because we don't do that for animations. Or maybe you actually don't use dependency injection. But the idea is I have an object that needs something else to work, right? Because I don't want to write all of my code in one class, right? So I start splitting the code into several parts. And then one class is going to use another class. And then the main question is how does that class A gets access to an instance of B? Does it get passed in, for example, through the constructor or a setter? Or does it reach out to some central object to find it, right? So get system service is not dependency injection because it's, I don't remember the name, it's basically going and reaching out for the thing you want versus passing the context in a view, in a view constructor is sort of dependency injection of the context dependency, right? So that's dependency injection. That's the idea that the dependency that you're going to need are going to be passed in. And as an object, you don't know where they're coming from. And then there are the libraries. So common ones, a very well-known one is Juice, which uses reflection to resolve that problem. The problem is, all right, I have all these objects and they have constructor parameters and I need to create instances. So I could write all that code manually to create every object I need. But that's a lot of boilerplate. And that's what the dependency injection libraries are solving. They create, so Juice uses reflection and create all these objects. Dagger generates the boilerplate code, and then it's generated with annotation processing, and you just use that. That's basically the idea. It's kind of a simple.
Okay. So, yeah, I knew that the Dagger was an attempt, and that comes from Square, right?
Well, it's
Dagger 1.
Yes.
Well, Dagger 2 is the one that uses annotation processing.
Well, no, both do.
Okay, so actually,
isn't
so
two the one that does static compilation? Like, there's no overhead. That's what I've been led to understand.
Well, so to detail a little bit, Dagger 1 does dependency injection with a little bit of reflection, and Dagger 2 is full no reflection at all.
Okay. So actually, I was talking to one of the Dagger 2 folks who I will have on the show as soon as he's a little more local than he happens to be right now.
Yeah.
But we'll find out more about that. But I guess from your perspective, that's the main difference between them. Is there a recommendation of one over the other? Or I mean, the general recommendation is like always avoid reflection when you can on Android.
Yeah.
Anywhere, really.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There are places where it matters more than others.
Like network, it's mostly okay because you're going to spend waiting so much time for the request to come back, for example, that you don't.
Yeah, it's more that you also have, you know, instead of static typing, you have string typing, which is.
So you're saying because networking takes so long, like it gives you something to do in the meantime. So it's like playing a game when you're in line at the register. Like you may as well use reflection because otherwise you're just going to get bored anyway.
Yeah, it's an example. So everything that's I/O related, where you know you're going to wait, if you add a couple milliseconds to something that's going to take 100 milliseconds, it doesn't really matter, I mean, in terms of perspective. The reason we use dependency injection is to really make it easy to have code that's like split, so you can reuse some parts. It makes it easy to test and pass some fake objects in it when you test it. And then it makes it really easy to like change the configuration if you have a dev build and a prod build, or at runtime switch endpoints in your dev build. There are a lot of things that you can do once you have dependency injection in place. And for me, as I write new features, I write a new screen component view, whatever, and then I'm like, oh, I'm gonna need this. All right, add inject this object, and I don't care where it's coming from. How do I get it? Is it gonna be there or not? I just know it's gonna be there.
All right. That's way beyond where I've thought about dependency injection before. So I guess we'll stop there. And I think we're going to wrap up pretty soon. But do you have quick thoughts on testing, especially since you're on the client side?
Right? I think the tools team has done an amazing job at improving the situation. It's much better than it once was. There's still, a bit of work. But right now, it's so great that we can actually run our unit test and our UI test in our IDE. We do that on a continuous integration. I think everybody should test. I do think, so one thing I like to say is that you should test your business logic. We don't care about testing the view, the animation, and how the color of that thing and whatnot. But
but you said UI testing or...
Well, UI testing is another level. You have Espresso, this kind of thing, where you actually test the entire app and you run through a flow of screens, and it's like manual QA, but someone's doing it for you. So it's
cheaper. That's not testing the UI as much as it is testing the entire app.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Full stack testing, and for the business logic testing, so JUnit.
Yeah, JUnit mostly. We use a touch of RoboElectric sometimes, but not even that much anymore. For the most part, everything that's in IntelliJ is really good right now. So,
And what do you do about covering the variety of devices that your app is going to be on?
Progressive rollouts.
Okay.
We have QA, but really what it is we just release to 5% and look at the crash rate and the support requests. And so it's like, sorry, guys. I think Facebook has a country where they do that. They release like the new version for like some random country that they always get the test version of the app.
Liechtenstein.
Yeah. Same country every time.
Someone they hate. I don't know.
They're like, oh, worst quality ever. Every build is terrible.
Yeah, but basically the progressive rollout is really our way to, we release it, we look at the crash rate, we fix the important ones, we do another dot release, we iterate.
Do you have, I know that there's some support in the Play Store for having like a beta channel, and you can, with Gradle, it's very easy to build different. So can you actually do different? Okay, so you have separate apps.
Yeah.
So it's not like you take a production app and just like everyone gradually gets it. You also do a first
We do beta, but like the real test is really the progressive one because we don't have enough beta users to actually catch all the important stuff.
I can't imagine why you wouldn't use a beta version for your payments app. I mean, what could go wrong?
Yeah, that's the thing too, right?
So if you depend on crash reports for fixing the problems before you send it out to everybody, where do you get the data? What are you using for crash reports?
That's an excellent question. So right now we use a library called Bugsnag, but I would recommend any of those. Crashlytics is a good example of those. The main thing is the Play Store isn't enough because it's doing the sensible thing, which is asking the user if they want to send the crash report. And so most people are going to say no. So you're not
opt-in thing.
Yeah. And you're not going to get all the crash reports that you want to get. And the main reason is because the Play Store doesn't know what's PII, what's private information versus not. So it's going to show the user, here is everything I'm going to send, and then it sends it. Whereas we, as app developers, when we capture a crash using these libraries, we usually know, oh, we should include this, we shouldn't include that. And so we include everything we can. Like stuff we include. So when you get a crash, right, you start looking at the stack trace. It's kind of the obvious. But that's mostly a filter to just solve all the easy problems. The real problems, the stack trace is not enough. When you have a crash, you want to reproduce the problem, right? So what you need to know is the state of the app at the time of the crash and the various history of states that it went through before getting to the crash. And to get that, what we use is basically a bunch of informations like a string representation of the view hierarchy, the device information. All of that is kind of the state of the app. And then we have some high-level log that tells you, oh, the user went there, and then there was an HTTP request to that endpoint. And then the user went here and pressed the back button and did that and did that.
So you track all this state sort of like a travel diary along the user using the app, and then on crash, that's when
we upload all that to the endpoint. And that's been super helpful to fix all sorts of crashes, really.
Cool.
All right. So speaking of crashes, I think we're out of time, so we're going to wrap up. I don't know if you had any brilliant wisdom pearls you wanted to drop on us.
No. One thing one last thing I want to say about Leak Canary is this is just the beginning. So apart from fixing the bugs, one of the really important things I want to do is consider doing a production work with Leak Canary. So here's just an idea. You get an out-of-memory error on the field in like a real user app. And then we analyze the heap dump locally and we send an extract of that, like the actual information, to the cloud. Because you're crashing anyway, taking a second to do a heap dump doesn't really matter. And then if you're going to fork and do that in a separate process, it shouldn't have a big impact. The interesting part is that you don't upload the heap dump, which is about 70 megs and contains private information, so you shouldn't upload that. But if you could find the useful information and send that, then we would not just... So we could still detect the memory leaks early with Leak Canary, but we could also tell the actual important leaks and how much memory they use. And so that's something that I really want to focus on in the coming months.
So integrating it with the crash reporting that you're already
doing. Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
And then as long as you're spending that much time collecting and sending the heap dump, you may as well do some reflection at the same time.
Yeah, I think we can add some dependency injection in there. That would
excellent.
Be cool.
You know, for the Solaris IDE, when it crashed, since it was a debugger, it registered a core dump handler, and when it would crash, it would attach itself in a separate process, debugging itself, running through a script, which would run like stack trace, evaluate variables, and then it would mail it to the user to say, hey, please forward this.
So, that's an amazing idea. Yeah. We should do that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.